All right. So you people gave me a problem, which is that this week you did what you were supposed to do and you read the chapter, and we then discussed the chapter, and the result was that I more or less ran out of stuff to say after the first day of a two-day week. And I thought what I would do first is to go back and discuss the idea of producer and consumer surplus, because I didn't really realize until we got into it last time that I had never actually covered that in this class, and I was sort of assuming this was stuff everybody knew, and it's fairly important stuff. And then after I do that, I want to do a sort of a quick pass over the stuff we were doing Monday over monopoly things, mostly covering things already said. And then I thought I would start on next week's subject, not including the part in the book. That basically, next week's topic is other legal systems, interesting other legal systems. The book chapter covers three of them. After I wrote the book, certainly not much before, but I think after, I started a seminar on legal systems very different from ours, so I now know about a bunch of other legal systems, and I figured that if we had time left after covering what we're supposed to be covering today, I could tell you about some other interesting legal systems that aren't in the book. So that's the plan for today, and I've actually on the recorder, Mirabile Dictu. So we can start going. Actually, it occurs to me before that, one other thing I might as well say, and that is, as you may know, next week they're doing a teach-in on sustainability. And we have been told we're all supposed to take some time in our classes to talk about sustainability. And I have volunteered to give a class during their teach-in, of which one version of the title is Sustainability, Rhetoric, or Mistake. Another version, I don't remember, I've got three different versions of various degrees of inflammability, but they have to do with the fact that as far as I can tell, sustainability is really a slogan which serves to sweep under the rug all of the hard questions and make it sound as though certain things are obviously good when they might be good but are not obviously so. So that's all I will say on that. If you're sufficiently curious, you could look at my blog where I got somewhat irritated when a colleague told me they were having a big program on sustainability, and I said, will there be any talks by people who are against it? And he said, well, if there are any talks people against it, if there are any talks against it, there'll be people who are for it. And it did not seem to me that was how universities are supposed to function.
When is it next week?
Yeah. I think I volunteered to give a talk on Tuesday. Whether that will be accepted, I don't know. But I've tried to make it fairly clear to the people involved that I'm a skeptic on this stuff.
Can you tell us on Monday
if it... Okay. Ask me.
Okay, great.
No, it's not at all clear what the term is supposed to mean. And if you sort of push through all of the fluff, you end up with a statement that's almost meaningless, that we are supposed to satisfy the needs of today without, handicapping the needs of tomorrow. That's not the language, but something like that. But anyway, all right. So let me start out, though, with consumer and producer surplus. And I start out with what's really the problem that they are a solution to, one of the problems they're a solution to. And that is, a long time ago, we talked about economic efficiency. And we've been talking about it sort of in the course of the law. But more generally, in economics, the question is, how would you figure out whether some particular thing, whether a law or government policy or whatever, produced net benefits or net losses in our sense? And my standard example for that is a tariff. Someone suggests you have a state tariff on steel or autos or something, import tax. It's clear some people will be better off if you do that. The producers of those things will have less competition. It's clear some people will be worse off. The consumers of those things will be paying higher prices. How could you figure out in principle whether on net there's a gain or a loss to Americans, even aside from the further question about the effects on our trading partners abroad? And the answer to that ultimately is the idea of consumer and producer surplus. And the idea, let's see how we're doing for this will do it in a moment. So the question we want to know is, how much is it worth to me to have the opportunity to buy some good at some price? Or sell, let's take profit for a moment. So imagine for a moment that this is my demand curve for steel, say, in the form of goods that have steel in it. And I've got the opportunity to buy all the steel I like, or all the apples, or whatever good this is, at this price. All right? And the effect of a tariff is probably going to be to change the price, so I'll now be paying, say, this price. And the effect of a subsidy would be to lower the price. You can think of lots of things that one might do that would affect these conditions. And we'd like some way of saying, what is the benefit to me of being able to buy as much of apples as I like at this price? And thus, how does the benefit change as the price changes? And if you don't think about it very much, it's tempting to say, well, if the price goes up to here, the result is that I'm paying an extra 50 cents for an apple if these are apples. 50 cents times this amount is some amount of money. That's the cost to me. And that's clearly wrong. And it's clearly wrong because not only am I buying fewer apples at a higher price, which costs me a higher price times the quantity of apples, that would be this area, I'm also losing whatever benefit I got from buying these apples, which I'm no longer buying. So now I've got to take account of that. And if you think about it a minute, more than a minute, you will realize that there is a fairly simple answer to the question. And the simple answer is that if you imagine my expanding my consumption of apples from 0 to 1 to 2 to 3, let us say, per month, or whatever units are, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, at each stage, the demand curve shows how much I would pay for getting that one more apple. All right? Because this demand curve shows that at this price, I'd buy this many apples. At this price, I'd buy this many. So that means that getting one more apple here is worth something between here and here. Because I wouldn't buy it at this price, would buy it at this. Well, if the apple is worth this much, if the price, let's take out this part for a moment, if the price is here, then my gain on that apple is what it's worth minus what it costs times one apple. All right? This is, let's say, the difference between 6 apples and 7 apples per month. That. Similarly, all the way down the curve, and we then realize that the value to me of being able to buy all the apples I want at this price is the area under the demand curve and above the price. For those of you who are comfortable with calculus, you might think of starting with a marginal value curve. Marginal value curve shows the value to me of one more apple as a function of the number of apples I'm consuming. And if we had a marginal value curve and apples were available at this price, we can now say, well, wait a minute. Certainly I'd buy the first apple. We know it's worth that much and this is what it costs. I'll buy the second, third, fourth. In fact, I'll buy apples out till I get to there because that's the point at which one, this is now marginal value rather than demand, because that's the point at which one more apple becomes worth less rather than more than it costs. But wait a minute. If it's the case that at any price I buy the quantity of apples, which is where the marginal value curve is, that looks an awful lot as though the marginal value curve and the demand curve are the same line. The demand curve shows how many apples I buy as a function of price. The marginal value curve shows me how much one more apple is worth as a function of quantity. They aren't literally the same because one is a function read this way and one is a function read this way. All right. In particular, it's logically possible that the marginal value curve might go like that. It's still a function because there's still one value of marginal value for every quantity. But that can't be a demand curve because at this price, there's got to be some quantity you buy. And it turns out that if the marginal value curve isn't monotonically sloping down, then the demand curve isn't quite the marginal value curve. But that's a somewhat fancy point which people are curious I can explain sometime, but not immediately. But the basic, but once you realize that the demand curve in the normal case is the marginal value curve, well then if you're comfortable with calculus, say, wait a minute, marginal value is the derivative of total value. So that means that the integral of marginal value equals total value. So that means that the total value to me of this quantity of apples is the area under this line, the integral from 0 to that quantity of marginal value. And we then say, all right, that's the value. If this price times quantity is what I have to pay for them, then my net benefit from getting the apples is that. All right? And so that, if you think about it, is really a very powerful tool because it answers the question, what's it worth to you to be able to buy stuff? And the answer is not, it's worth whatever it costs. In fact, you would go to a good deal of trouble to get to the store that sells apples at this price in order to have the opportunity to buy this many apples, because doing so would you get me that amount of surplus. All right, so far, questions? No questions? All right, that's consumer surplus. The one final point is that I've been putting all of this in terms of one person. But if you think about multiple people, you should be able to see that demand curves add horizontally. That the demand curve of the three of us is at any given price how much I buy plus how much you buy plus how much he buy. So that's, if we imagine three different demand curves at this price, one of us buys that much, one of us buys that much, one of us buys that much, so our combined demand is this, plus that, is out there. All right? Makes sense? But if you then think about it, you ought to be able to see with a little playing with the geometry that the area under this summed line is just the sum of the three areas associated with this, and therefore the consumer surplus from the market demand curve is simply the sum of the individual consumer surpluses. All right, that's, I shouldn't skip that step because we're normally thinking about millions of people, not one person. So that means that now we have a tool to tell us what our benefit is from this. We don't normally use this tool by actually measuring demand curves. What we do is to analyze the effect on prices given the demand curve of some change. And I could point you at the chapter in my price theory book, which is Web, where I go through the tariff case. And basically what I do there is to say, suppose we have an economy with two goods, one of which we import and one of which we export. You put a tariff on the import goods. I need the export good because one effect of a tariff is that we import less and thus export less, because foreigners have fewer dollars to spend on our goods. You then see how the various curves and prices would change if you did that, which doesn't require you know the real curves. It only requires that you know the logic of how a tax changes a curve. And you can then prove mathematically pretty easily that the net, I haven't gotten to producer surplus yet, I'll get to that in a minute, but that the net effect on surplus of everybody concerned is negative, that the tariff results in costs in this sense for the losers larger than. So that's why the whole concept is important in terms of this whole idea of deciding what the economic conditions are. All right, and that's sort of a very quick once over. And as I said, my price theory book's up on the web if you want to do the work of reading the whole thing. Producer surplus. Let's think about the same question from the other side. What we're now doing is not eating apples, but mowing lawns. And this is the price I am offered to mow a lawn. At this fairly low price, I'd only be willing to mow one lawn a week. As the price goes up, I'm willing to mow more and more lawns per week. All right. Exactly the argument we used before still works. Putting it in marginal terms, this is really a marginal disvalue curve. This says that if this is, let us say, $10, if I'm mowing this number of lawns per week, the disutility to me of mowing one more lawn is about $10. That's why I wouldn't mow the next lawn where the disutility is higher, but would have mowed the previous lawn. Okay. Well, take the same argument as before. If I could mow all the lawns I like at $10, I mow one instead of zero, get $10, my margin of disutility is down here, so that's a benefit of that amount. Repeat going up. And the area under price and above my supply curve now, this is my supply curve for mowed lawns, it shows at any price how many lawns I'll mow, that area is my benefit for mowing lawns. So again, people often carelessly talk about as if, let us say, having the government spend $50,000 in your city hiring people is a $50,000 benefit. But of course it isn't, because in exchange for that, they got to work. They may have to give up other jobs or leisure or whatever. The benefit is only the amount above the lowest that they take, essentially, the producer surplus. I don't know if I mentioned there was another online discussion that was sort of fun where somebody was asserting, for all I presume correctly, though I don't know, that if you calculated for each state how much money the federal government collected in taxes there and how much money the federal government spent there, that the ratio of expenditures to taxes tended to be high in the so-called red states, which are states which seem to vote on the whole against government spending, and low in the blue states. And this was supposed to be evidence that the red state voters were foolish people who didn't know their own interests. And there are lots of problems with that argument. But in particular, putting it that way makes it sound as though if you tax $5,000 from us and spend $5,000 on us, that's a wash. And if you tax $5,000 from us and spend $6 on us, that's a gain. But that's wrong, because spending $6,000 on us isn't the same thing as giving us $6,000. You're spending $6,000 in exchange for us spending a certain number of hours of work doing something or producing goods and selling it to you or whatever. And therefore, it's only the producer surplus that can count and not the amount spent. So on the logic of their argument, it could be that all of those states were worse off. Now, they could also be better off, because, of course, the argument for having the government tax and spend is the belief that when the government spends $1,000, it produces more than $1,000 worth of benefit. So the point is not that you could say who's right or wrong, but only that the logic of their argument depended on this fairly common mistake of identifying the amount spent somewhere with the benefit to the people of spending it somewhere. All right, so that's the basic idea of producer surplus and consumer surplus. And one thing, as I say, it can be used for answering questions such as, does the tariff make the country that puts it on better off? And what's the effect of price control? Where you can say, you know, the price control holds the price to here. How does that affect surplus and so forth and so on? It's a very powerful and useful set of tools. It turns out, as we saw, assuming that you followed the stuff without having had the proper additional stuff done by me last time, that it is also a useful tool for a monopoly. Because one way of thinking about that surplus is that it is how much I would pay to have the opportunity to buy apples at this price. Well, if I have to be a monopoly seller of apples, that's very useful information to me. And so that gets to what I think of as the popcorn puzzle, which is sort of a question that runs through my price theory textbook. It was sort of a useful one to teach various things. And the popcorn puzzle, as I mentioned before, is why is the popcorn's effective? It is expensive in movie theaters. And the standard answer most people would make is they have a monopoly. And that answer by itself is wrong. And the reason it's wrong is they have a monopoly once you're inside the theater, but they can't force you into the theater. So if you imagine for a moment that I'm going to imagine for the moment that all the customers are identical. That turns out to be a dangerous assumption, as we'll see later on, but it makes life very simple, so we'll start there. So this is one of the many identical customers. And we will suppose that this is the cost to the movie theater of producing popcorn. All right. Marginal cost. Each additional, if no fixed cost for some reason, each additional unit costs a certain amount. And now the question is, suppose that the theater decides to sell popcorn at this price. The value to the customers of being able to buy popcorn at that price is this area. That's the consumer surplus. All right? Suppose the theater dropped the price all the way down to marginal cost. When they drop it all the way down to marginal cost, one of these markers in here somewhere, I think, in a different color. If they drop it down to marginal cost, the theater loses. Oops, two black ones. That's not what I want. There should be a red one. And I've just put caps on both ends of that, which is why I couldn't find the cap. This was not clever.
The top, very top segment is called marginal surplus. So
consumer surplus.
Consumer purpose. Surplus.
The consumer surplus is the area. This is the consumer surplus at this price. There'd be a different consumer surplus at a lower price.
Yeah.
Suppose we drop the price down from here all the way to marginal cost. We're very generous. We think people should enjoy their popcorn. We lose on popcorn revenue this area. Is that clear? Because we're not making any money on popcorn anymore because we're selling at exactly cost. Previously, we were making this much per unit of popcorn because that's the price above cost times this amount of popcorn. And we've just thrown away that monopoly profit. All right? Which seems like a very foolish thing for us to have done until we look at the problem a little further and we say, wait a minute, what has happened to consumer surplus as a result of this? Well, consumer surplus has gone up by that amount because the surplus is now the whole area above this line. It used to be above this, so it's increased by this. Well, what do we say? We have now made the experience of visiting our theater and seeing a movie this much more attractive to our customers. As part of what they're getting is the benefit of eating popcorn. That means we can raise our ticket price by that amount and get the same number of customers. All right. Customer, we've just raised the value of our product by this area, raised the price of the product by the same amount. Customers who were willing to buy it before are willing to buy it now. All right. So we've lost this. We've gained this. Hence, our total gain from dropping the price is that triangle. We are now richer rather than poorer. Now, you might say, well, if that's such a great idea, why don't we drop it even further? Suppose we took the price all the way down to zero, gave our popcorn away to prove what nice people we were. Well, if you think about it, when we give the popcorn away, we are now losing this area beyond what we were losing before. Because we're selling, we're giving it away at zero. This is what it costs us to produce. This is how much we're giving away. So the amount we're giving away times what we're losing. Our production cost is that area. All right? But we only increased the consumer surplus by this amount. So therefore, the result of that is a net loss of that amount. All right? And if you think through the argument, it's pretty easy to see that we maximize our profit selling at marginal cost. And that's sort of interesting because selling at marginal cost is exactly what the economists in our freshman economics course told us monopolies ought to do for economic efficiency. And it's not an accident because economic efficiency is maximizing the summed gain to seller plus buyer. This pricing scheme makes sure that all the gain goes to the seller. Because he is charging, he is already charging the ticket price, which is just the highest price. Customers are all identical, right? So he doesn't have to worry about scaring away some and not others. So if his customers value the film at putting aside the popcorn benefits at $10, he's charging $9.99. Now, doing this, by dropping this to here and then raising the price by that amount, he's transferring all of the consumer surplus from popcorn to his pocket. In addition to these. Clear? Well, if all the surplus goes to him, then the policy that maximizes surplus also maximizes profit. Does that make sense? Yes? No? If I'm a monopolist, and I can arrange things so that all consumer surplus is magically turned into producer surplus, and I want to maximize producer surplus, then I want to maximize total surplus. So that sort of is a neat result. Yep.
So this is only a model for if there's one theater chain, right?
No. The theater, it's an interesting question. To begin with, most theaters have some monopoly power because usually they aren't all showing the same film. But I think even in the competitive case, since once you're inside, they've got a monopoly on popcorn. In the competitive case, the highest ticket price they can charge is going to be determined by what the competitors are charging. That is the most customers will pay, not because the movie isn't worth more than that, because they can always go down the street to the other one. But then the highest price you can charge is raised by anything that increases the surplus they get from the popcorn. If your competitor is charging popcorn at a high price, you charge it at a low price, you can now charge a higher ticket price than he does by exactly the difference. All right? So the argument actually goes through with the competitive market. I was really sort of assuming a monopoly in the way I presented it. So that's sort of neat. And then the question is, if this is right, why isn't popcorn cheap in movie theaters? And as I said, maybe the answer is that it is. You know, I've never run a movie theater, and maybe given the special circumstances of selling stuff 10 minutes every 2 hours or whatever it comes to, maybe it's really expensive to sell popcorn. But suppose it isn't. Then we have to drop the assumption we made a moment ago, which was the customers are all identical. And once we allow for the fact that different customers have different demand curves, we now realize that the ticket price that will get all of the surplus from you will get only some of the surplus from him because he really likes the movie or he's rich or something or he's showing off for his girlfriend. And that same ticket price will keep you out of the theater entirely because it will be above the value to you. And I have to figure out how to maneuver in that world as the entrepreneur running the theater. And, yeah?
Sorry. I just wanted to give some factual background.
Yes.
I worked in a theater for a couple of years.
I see. I thought you were going to tell us you weren't trying to impress your girlfriend.
No, that you have to do. But yep. But just so you know, like, the marginal cost for soda and popcorn is, like, just nothing. I mean, it's very, very, very low.
You're including the labor costs.
Even that. I mean, yeah. I swear to God, it's almost, it's relative to the price that you're paying for,
very, very
for a soda.
Yeah.
It costs like 10 cents to make it or something,
right.
Or 15 cents.
Right.
And then you pay $5 for it.
Right.
So, and then the movie tickets seem high too. And then the theater itself, like the company that owns it, barely breaks even. It all goes into the movie. So there's
But given a competitive market,
yeah,
buying the movies, given that the theaters are competing to rent the movies from the studios, you would expect that would tend to drive the price to the point at which the theaters are just covering their costs,
right,
and other competitive things. But going back to this, you now have some customers who have high demand curves, some customers who have low demand curves. You'd like to find a way in which you can charge the high price to the ones who will pay a high price to the low price. One way is things like lower prices for kids. But another way is to say, if it is true, and this is the critical thing, if it's true that on average the people who would be willing to pay a high price for the ticket are also the people who buy a lot of popcorn, then pushing the price above marginal cost, even though it's inefficient in terms of losing some surplus, results in raising the price to the high-demand customers more than to the low-demand customers. Since if I raise the price to the high-demand customers and the low-demand customers, raising the price to the high-demand customers doesn't lose me any customers because they're the people who are willing to pay more than I'm charging already. Keeping the price down to the low-demand customers means I don't scare them away. I only have to cut my ticket price a little bit because they're not buying much popcorn. They're probably smuggling popcorn in or something. And therefore, it's an imperfect way of doing price discrimination. Notice, suppose for a moment, not too plausibly, that the result was the reverse. Suppose what's happening is that we're in a world where poor people go into the movie theater and fill up in popcorn because they couldn't afford dinner, whereas rich people go to a fancy restaurant and then go out to the movie theater and they're stuffed and they don't want any popcorn. How do we price discriminate in that world?
You make the tickets
cheaper? The higher ticket price and cheaper popcorn.
Cheap, but that's right. We give the popcorn away. We make the popcorn less than, we sell the popcorn at less than marginal cost. We subsidize the popcorn, thus making the theater more attractive to the low demand customers. Doesn't matter if the high demand who aren't buying any, and we can now raise our price an amount which just balances the low demand effect, but which is a real price rise for the high demand customers who aren't getting any benefit from the subsidized popcorn. Exactly correct. So that's the basic logic. And as a part of what I find neat about it is you have this tool which you originally introduced in terms of these grand questions of whether tariffs make the country better or worse off, and then it turns out to actually be relevant to making sense of the behavior in individual firms who are dealing with the same situation. So let's see. Where do I want to go from there? Other examples which I've discussed, this is the popcorn case, but other examples are my cookie company before, which was selling cookies, and again, it maximized its profit with identical customers by selling the cookies at marginal cost and charging an entry fee to be allowed to buy cookies, a membership of the cookie club, which is just equal to the consumer surplus at that cost. Again, they're using price discrimination to transfer all surplus to themselves, and once they do that, it's in their interest to maximize the total surplus. So in terms of who gets how many cookies, they're doing exactly what the benevolent economist central planner would want them to do, making sure that everybody who values a cookie, at least at the marginal cost, gets it. And it's true that they're also making sure that all the benefit goes to them instead of the customers, but we economists claim we don't care who gets the money, we're just adding up the total, so why should we object to the fact that these virtuous cookie bakers are making out like bandits relative to their customers? All right, that's the sort of logic of the argument. So, any questions on the consumer-producer surplus stuff before I go on to a quick review?
I guess it's not a question about it, it's more a question about how it relates to antitrust law.
Sure.
Because it seems that the base concern with antitrust law is the opposite of what you just said. It's not so much it's that they are concerned that you know, whatever company Rockefeller is making out like managing supposedly at the detriment to.
But it depends in a sense on who's concerned. And the economist's concern with the subject is that every dollar Rockefeller makes is costing us $2 or whatever. The economist's concern is that it results in inefficient behavior. Undoubtedly, some politician's concern is that it results in making some of my voters worse off and only a few of my voters better off. Another politician's concern might be the other direction. It might be it results in giving lots of money to this fine, generous man named Mr. Rockefeller, who will contribute to my campaign funds, and the people who are worse off wouldn't have contributed anyway. So you can think of lots of different things people might be concerned with. Certainly a lot of the rhetoric is rich versus poor, seller versus buyer. But the end I'm really looking at is the economist's end of asking the question whether and why it makes us worse off, so to speak, on net, and us includes Rockefeller as well as the customers. But no, you're perfectly right that is an issue there. But then the economist's, the sophisticated economist's response is going to be that for a perfect price discriminating monopoly, our standard problem goes away, but we have a rent-seeking problem that replaces it, because now companies will spend resources, perhaps enter the industry early, in order to make sure that they're the one who has that monopoly and gets that monopoly profit. So that's just... In the sort of the pessimal case, which is the opposite of optimal, in the pessimal case, all surplus goes to the monopolist, and all surplus is then burned up trying to become the monopolist.
Would trying to raise barriers to entry also be rent-seeking? Not just getting in early, but, you know, whether it be lobbying to get a law passed or paying a lot of money to get something started.
One of the points that Tulloch made in the classic welfare cost of tariffs, monopoly, and theft was that part of the deadweight cost of tariffs, which is not included in the analysis in my price theory, is the money spent lobbying for them. And that's rent-seeking, in that you're lobbying to benefit yourself, not by producing more, but by benefiting yourself at someone else's expense. Which is basically what rent-seeking is about. Yep.
Actually, it might be too off-topic. I can just ask you after class. But I have another question about rent-seeking.
Yes.
Is whether advertising...
That's very tricky. There certainly are cases where firms and industry will be better off if you ban advertising, because they're spending the money to compete with each other. On the other hand, advertising also, I think, has two other functions. One of them is information. It tells you this particular good with these particular characteristics is available here. And the other one, which is sort of odder, but I think is really there, is to add additional characteristics to the good. So if you think about the cigarette ads, where the guy is riding off on a horse into the Rocky Mountains smoking a Marlboro, presumably part of what that's doing is to increase the pleasure that Marlboro smokers get. Because when you're smoking a Marlboro, you're imagining yourself to be riding off into that. And if you sort of look at people's behavior, there's an awful lot of stuff like that. That it seems to me that if you think about the hunter, part, I suspect, of the pleasure of hunting is imagining yourself as the sort of Daniel Boone character out bravely facing the wilderness, feeding your family and so forth, even though you know that it would probably cost you less to go to the supermarket and buy your meat instead. Similarly, if you think about a bunch of sort of vaguely environmentalist things like home gardens that people are doing, not because they've actually calculated that raising vegetables this way is a better deal, but because it makes them feel close to nature and sort of gives them an identity as responsible people. And in fact, I would argue that a bunch of this sustainability stuff is really doing a version of that. It's letting people feel good about themselves. And the only problem is that you don't have a whole lot of incentive in any of these stories to figure out whether you're really doing good or not, as long as you can feel good about yourself. Yeah.
What would be an example of an industry where advertising is just probably inefficient? Probably doesn't create a lot of value.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. It would presumably be some case where there is very little information being generated, where people already know what they need to know, and it's all a matter of... What?
Soda pop, maybe?
Maybe. Well, everybody knows that Diet Coke's better than Diet Pepsi. I've never had the courage to do the double-blind experiment to see if I really have the preferences I think I have with regard to those drinks. That could be sure. If you've got two very close to identical products, and the only idea is whichever one you've heard about latest. But it's tricky, and I don't know enough about advertising. There's a story I remember a friend of mine in the advertising industry telling me a long time ago, which I guess is a classic story of what he refers to as vampire video. And this involves a big advertising campaign for a product in some field where there are two products, like Coke and Pepsi. And it's the kind of campaign which is writing no information at all. It's showing a beautiful girl drinking the product, basically. Maybe a beautiful girl in a fancy sports car drinking the product. And that's supposed to be good. And he says, you know, they did a study after they did this campaign, and they asked customers how many customers remembered which of the two products was being advertised. And 19% of the customers said they remembered which of the two products were being advertised. And 10% of them were right, 9% were wrong. And vampire video, the point being that you're pulling the attention away from the product onto the pretty girl. You're not actually offering a pretty girl, and therefore you aren't going to get them to buy more. So I don't know enough about it to know how much of advertising fits in one category, but it's certainly a legitimate question. In any case, all right, so let me go on to my quick version on Monopoly. I assume if you have any questions, you will have asked them by now. If not, speak very rapidly. Basic kind of Monopoly, the one which I think is perhaps most interesting to economists, is natural monopoly. That's the case where a firm big enough to supply all the market wants at its price can sell at a lower cost than anybody else because their production costs are lower. And the natural monopolies that get a lot of attention are big ones. Arguably the ones that are more important, more common, are the small ones. The monopoly of the one grocery store in a small town, the novelist, the Agatha Christie person, the author who writes a particular kind of niche literature in a particular style which her customers really like better than anybody else's style and stuff like that. But all of those are really natural monopolies, and in all of those you're likely to end up with a single producer. Second kind of monopoly, and one which is maybe at least on the large scale more important in a modern society, is state monopoly, monopoly enforced by the law. That includes government-run monopoly. The post office is now nominally private, but for a very long time it wasn't, and I'm not sure how private it really is. And the private express statutes back in the 19th century made it illegal for private firms to compete in carrying first-class mail with the post office. So that's one kind of a monopoly. Another kind of government monopoly is one where it's not that it's illegal to compete, but that the product is subsidized with tax money, so it's very hard to compete. And, of course, the big example there would be public schools. So that in the U.S., public schools are monopolies, local monopolies. You do have a little competition from private schools, but since the private schools have to charge enough to pay for their costs and the public schools don't, most of the customers are going to the public school. So that's a different kind of monopoly enforced in a different way, by a subsidy rather than by a ban. Then there are a bunch of things that are, maybe monopoly isn't quite right, but at least anti-competitive situations created by government for private actors. So you have very commonly in cities, you have to have a license to be a barber. The license has barriers to entry, which seem to have very little to do with whether you're any good at being a barber. You have to take 200 hours of classes on hair care or something. And that's, in effect, providing a kind of a monopoly privilege, although it's more like sort of a guild privilege in that it's a monopoly divided among a bunch of producers. But since you're keeping down the number of producers, you're pushing down the output and up the price in the same way as an ordinary monopoly. Another big example along those lines in the U.S. would be federal regulation of transport. So if you look at the history of the Interstate Commerce Commission, history of the Civil Aeronautics Board, in each of those cases you have a government agency which has the power to control what rates firms can charge and what they can do. That the Interstate Commerce Commission starts out regulating railroads, where there was some plausible argument of natural monopoly, but it goes on to regulate barges, which were a competitive industry. Why? Because they were competing with the railroads. It then goes on to regulate trucking, which is a competitive industry. Why? Because it's competing with the railroads. And you end up with a situation where it's illegal to be doing trucking from city A to city B unless the ICC has given you permission to do so. I'm not sure if this is still true or not. There's been various deregulations from Clinton. No, from not Clinton, anyway, earlier president.
Carter.
Yeah, that's right. It was really a Cornell economist who I actually knew slightly. I'm trying to remember his name. It was who did it, at least for the airlines. So it's illegal. So you're controlling entry, and obviously when you ask for permission to carry stuff from Milwaukee to Chicago, all the trucking lines that are currently carrying there will go before the ICC and testify that they have enough trucks to satisfy the demand there, and there's no need for additional firms. With luck, they'll stop you. At least with their luck, they'll stop you. And the classic example for the airlines back when the airlines were still under this system was Pacific Southwest Airlines, which flew between San Francisco and Los Angeles. The federal regulation only applied to interstate airlines, and so PSA wasn't under the regulation. And at the time, the fare from San Francisco to Los Angeles was about half the fare for similar length routes interstate elsewhere in the country. So that's a form of it. Finally, there's another form of government-created monopoly, which you can make arguments both for and against, but which should be of special interest to you as lawyers, and that's intellectual property law, patents and trade secrets, patents and copyrights. And that is a monopoly. It is granted by the government. The government says, you may not compete with me in producing and selling my book or my patented idea. And if you think about it, part of what's interesting about the IP case is that that might be a case where rent-seeking is a feature rather than a bug. Because after all, rent, what would have been rent-seeking is spending resources on becoming the monopoly. How do I become the copyright monopoly? I write a book. Why do we have copyright? To give people a reason to write books. How do I become a patent monopoly? I make an invention and go get it patented. Why do we have patent? The theory is basically to get people to make inventions. So that's an interesting case where the law, the economics is still the same, and yet you can at least argue that the implications are different. I say you can argue because I think it's an open question whether IP law is good or bad, that it clearly has costs and benefits and it's very hard to evaluate. Let me go back. You may remember the homesteading case, which we discussed a long time ago when we were talking about rent seeking and the idea that we more or less dissipated the land value of the U.S. by premature settlement. And I once read and I think refereed an article, I don't know if it was ever published or not, by somebody who was making exactly the form of argument I'm now making on homesteading. What he was saying is that homesteading does indeed encourage premature settlement in the sense of settlement before it's in the private interest of the settler, aside from the fact that he's getting ownership of the land. Settling at a point when you're still losing money year by year by settling there. But he said this wasn't a mistake, because the government wants to encourage settlement, because after all, if we don't get to that land first, the Canadians might get to it, or the Mexicans might get to it. And even if neither the Canadians or the Mexicans are a problem, there are these people who are living there called Indians. And when I move out and settle here, that makes it easier for you to settle here because the Indians will be less willing to massacre me if there are 500 other people like me who will come after them if they do. So his argument really was that what was premature settlement from a private standpoint might have been an efficient level of settlement from a public standpoint, and therefore maybe this was a sensible. Whether he was right, I don't know, but I just thought it was an interesting idea. Now, of course, you could say, but wait a minute, that's still rent-seeking. It's just that we're rent-seeking not from other American homesteaders, but from the Canadians and the Mexicans and the Indians. We're trying to make sure we have the land instead of their having the land. So in that sense, it still is, but not yet.
Only when you're done with the...
I'll stop. I finished what I'm saying.
Okay. I realized I did have one question about the reading.
Great.
Which is about the Standard Oil example.
Yes.
I don't know much about it, You know, except like a few great history.
Did you know, by the way, that they were not selling gasoline?
I had no idea. All I remember is the picture of the octopus.
Cars
were my history book.
Yeah. Cars were not yet of any importance at that point. They're selling kerosene.
Oh yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Whatever. Okay. So my question was, and maybe this isn't so much about Standard Oil as other examples.
Yep.
Of
predatory pricing.
Of predatory pricing, right, which is why can't you simply have different prices in different regions.
Well, but maybe you can, but if there isn't a natural monopoly, then either you're small for... If there isn't a natural... Question is, on what scale is there not a natural monopoly? If there is a natural monopoly on the regional scale, if a firm that sells everything in a region can produce at a cheaper price than a smaller firm can, and if transport costs are high, then you do have a natural monopoly. You've got a natural monopoly of producing kerosene in Illinois. Right. If either at the regional level the small firm is still as efficient as the big firm, or if transport costs are low so that the relevant market is the national market rather than the regional market, then the same argument goes on as before, because now every time you try to hold your price up here in this region, some small firm starts in and makes out like bandits. Maybe even this small firm starts a small firm over there to do it. And if transportation costs are low, then you get with a corn planter story, which is, all right, you're going to cut your prices in Illinois. Great, we're investigating market outlets in Missouri and Ohio and New York and Pennsylvania, and we're going to make you cut your prices all over the place if you want to keep us from selling. So it really, in the one case, we're back to natural monopoly, transport costs plus smaller market. And that, you don't need predatory pricing. You can just sell at a price at which you can make money, and they can. And the other, right.
So I just want to make sure I understand how that would apply in a case like typically people would say something like Walmart, right, which will go into a small town, like where, say, there is a natural monopoly by one department store.
Right.
And let's say it's locally owned or a state one or whatever, it doesn't matter. And they go in and they definitely have lower prices than the one store with a natural monopoly.
But can Walmart sell at a lower price than that store can sell and still make money?
Well, so they don't have to do it forever. They only have to do it for a short amount of time. So, as I understand what you're saying, the solution would be that another chain would do the same thing.
Or the one that they're going to drive out gets together with other people and says, wherever their prices are high, we will have one too. Assuming that it's not a natural monopoly, then our chain can have a tenth of the capital assets of Walmart and still compete with them. And as far as I can tell, these stories about Walmart and such, at least when people tell the stories, they never seem to have examples where they later raise prices. That seems to be...
They also are very, very, very profitable, too. So they're definitely
making
money.
And Walmart exists, and as far as I know, sells low prices in areas where everybody is shopping via automobile, and where, in fact, I mean, you can go to a Costco. I assume there's a Walmart. There's a... what the other one is. The areas like this, where you've got multiple big box stores, and they all seem to be functioning, and so it can't be that that's their basic business model. Anyway, all right. So next thing, you were actually going to was my next topic, which is artificial monopoly, but having covered the predatory pricing half of the artificial monopoly, let me now go to the other half, which is merger to monopoly. And there you can imagine the case, especially if entering an industry takes a while, you've got to learn the skills and make the contacts and stuff, you can imagine a case where you have almost natural monopoly. So there are two or three or four firms, and now the firms get together and they say, look, it's true, our administrative costs will be a little higher if we merge, but if we merge, we got no competitors, we can raise prices. And as long as we don't raise them high enough to pull in a fifth firm, or as long as it takes a while to happen, we can make money. And the standard approach in U.S. law at this point is that the government won't give you permission to merge if they think that's what's going on. And the obvious problem is there are lots of other reasons to merge, and if you prevent mergers which are taking advantage of synergies between companies, you then make us all poorer. And I mentioned in the book my friend's suggestion about how the antitrust division could decide which mergers to permit. I should say this is, I think, if I remember correctly, the same friend who has this scheme for buying secondhand cars where you ask for a guarantee. I think these are both Ami Glaser and UC Irvine. It was a colleague of mine for one quarter line. No, he's a clever guy. And his scheme is that when companies A and B in some industry, which are two big companies, want to merge, you ask smaller companies in the industry C, D, and E what they think of it. And if the smaller companies say, we think that merger is a terrible thing, they're creating a monopoly, they're going to exploit you, you say, great, we'll approve it. Because why do they think it's a terrible thing? because it's not a merger of a monopoly, because a merger of a monopoly would be a great thing for the other firms, because it would then drive up the price and they could make money. But a merger that results in the merged firm being able to produce better qualities cheaper, the competitors aren't going to like. Whereas if the competitors say, go ahead and do it, then you suspect it's a merger of a monopoly and you forbid it. It's obviously not going to work, but it's a clever idea anyway. It's various about these ideas. So anyway, that's that case. I should say, I'm not sure how much it's changed my views, but I've had a good deal of firsthand experience of imperfectly competitive markets over the last year or two in World of Warcraft. Because for any of you who've played it, World of Warcraft has these auction houses. And in some cases, for some of the goods being produced and sold, the market's thin enough that there aren't very many sellers. And you observe the pattern sometimes of somebody who is one of the major sellers who deliberately follows a policy of charging a high price for something, and every time anybody else puts up that something at a lower price, buy at the lower price and put it back up at the high price in order to try to hold the price up. And there's an obvious problem with this, which is that if the other person notices you're doing it, they'll keep making more and more of these things, and you're going to end up with a whole bunch of stuff you can't sell because you're buying their output and then trying to sell it at a price at which fewer will be bought. But if the other people aren't very energetic about this and aren't paying very much attention, you may be able for a while to, you know, sell 9 of your units out of 10 at a much higher price than this. This is related to an old economist's, I guess I don't call it a joke, a story or an anecdote, which is the story is that you have stamp collectors, and there's some famous stamp of which only 3 of them exist. And there's an auction, and a bidder buys 3 of them, all 3. And he then stands up in front of the audience, takes one of the 3, takes out his lighter, and burns it. The assumption is that he believes that will increase by more than 50% the price of the other 2, since there are now only 2. And that's a case where you're trying to make out of the raised price. The World of Warcraft case, I should say, first came to my attention through my wife, because my wife was invited to join a cartel. She was producing, I think it was gemstones, as I remember, in World of Warcraft, and the dominant character who was trying to do this kind of game basically said to her, you know, stop underselling us, come in with us, you'll get to sell a certain fraction of what we sell at a high price. And she refused, and then the person in question threatened her and said, you know, you're never going to sell anymore, whatever you sell, I'll undersell you, I'll cut below cost, and so forth. This person had not read McGee on the difficulties of predatory pricing. My wife had read McGee on the difficulty of predatory pricing, and she said, fine, feel free. And after 2 or 3 days, the other person gave up, stopped deliberately trying to sell below cost and then losing money. And I should say, this same person has been doing it for a couple of years, because I encounter her now in that same market. And part of what's going on there, I suspect, given the nature of that market, is that this is somebody who is spending something like 14 hours a day not just playing World of Warcraft, but in the auction house of World of Warcraft. And the virtue of doing that, if you're willing to do it, he or she may really be, bedridden or something. This may be, you know, could easily be somebody who has a reason why she can't do anything else. But in any case, but one part of that pattern, which is interesting, it's sort of fun to try to do a mathematical economic analysis of it, is suppose your policy is you put things up at a high price. The competitor puts it in a price very slightly lower, because after all, people will buy it a little bit lower. As soon as that happens, you put yours in, you know, one unit below that person. If you're watching much more than everybody else is, then 90% of the time, at the point when somebody wants to buy, yours is the low one. So that sort of is an interesting tactic, which, yeah.
Just really quick, yep. In that game, do you make your own offer? Like, you sort of create your own?
In that game, the seller sets a price. Actually, the seller sets 2 prices. In theory, the way the World of Warcraft works is you have one price, which is a starting price, and one, which is a buyout price. And the buyout price means that anybody who wants to can buy the good for that price. The starting price means that anybody who wants to can offer that amount or more. But that's then an auction, it goes for a certain length of time, and somebody else can raise the price and so forth. In practice, that sounds sort of neat in theory, but what happens in practice usually is that people buy at the buyout price because it takes too much time and attention to be a buyer in an auction. Not always. Sometimes what you might do, if there's something which is an input to making stuff you craft, and you know you're going to want a bunch of it, what you may do is to notice when there are low auction prices, put up a bid on it, and just see if you get it. And, you know, occasionally nobody else raises it, you get it cheap.
So there's a commodity price,
each individual. That you've got a particular ember topaz. I should say, if you haven't done World of Warcraft, things like gemstones aren't just ornament. The way the game works, you've got armor which has got sockets in it. And when you put a gemstone in the socket, that improves the quality of the armor. You know, you do more damage or you're stronger or something. So it really is a productive thing, even though it's done in the form of calling them gemstones. And so what happens is, any seller can put a stone up at any price he likes. Any price asking, any price buyout. But in practice, if someone's got that stone up at 90, there's not a whole lot of point in putting yours up at 100. The only reason to do that is that, well, he's only got one at 90, and probably in the next 8 hours, two people will want to buy, and I'm not going to pay attention, so I'll put mine up at 100. But normally, when you put one up, you put it up below the price of whoever's got the previous one.
How do the people know what price is there, like an average?
You see each one. You come into the auction house, and it shows you so-and-so has an ember topaz up for this price. So-and-so has the same kind of ember topaz up at this price. So you're seeing a list of, you know, we've got computers in this fantasy world. You see the name of the seller, and you see the asking price and the buyout price, and you see if it's set up as an auction, how long it's an auction for. Approximately, just in big categories. So it's really quite interesting. You start thinking about getting your hands on a thin market, an imperfectly competitive market. Here is one where lots of people from, you know, age 9 to 90 or something are in here playing this game, engaging in the auctioning. I thought it would be sort of fun, probably at a big school, to do an econ course, which was basically a World of Warcraft econ course. You want a big school because you want to have a class where you've got like at least 15 or 20 students, all of whom are already World of Warcraft enthusiasts, already know this world or experienced with it, and can try to learn economics and make sense of it. Because, one of the very interesting questions, which I'm not sure the answer to, is whether you have an efficient market or not. The question is, are there ways in which, with a little cleverness, you could make money without doing anything but just buying low and selling high? And it's hard to tell, because it's hard to tell. Certainly prices of things go up and down a lot, but it's hard to tell what's predictable. And there's always the danger that you say, oh, the prices are low, I should stock up really big. But the reason prices are low is something has changed, and they're going to get lower and lower.
One area to think about this, one area that actually might happen, because they open new servers, probably not more recently, but they open new servers all the time. I imagine those probably follow some sort of predictable trend.
I don't know.
When players
being at
different levels, and there's this many players, it seems that low-level goods at one point are going to be kind of going high and then taking off as nobody needs them anymore. It seems if you know that pattern, you
might be possible.
Probably beat the market.
There's one thing that I'm really curious about. Is there somewhere, are there people out there who are... who are Warren Buffetts in World of Warcraft, who are successful speculators in World of Warcraft. And some of it is, it looks as though there are some price differences between weekend and weekday, and that would be really easy to take advantage of. Well, on the other hand, there's also the auction house charges a cut when you auction, so you've got to make enough, just like in Las Vegas, you've got to make a large enough profit to take out the house cut to make it work. But it just strikes me as sort of, it's an interesting world in general that social scientists could be doing experiments on, because here you've got every server is a separate world, so you could do statistical experiments in which you do things in 50 different servers and see what happens when you do different things in different places and so forth. And I haven't. Yeah.
I had a friend, actually. Do you remember the game EverQuest?
Yes, I never played it, but I know what it was.
So similar. He actually spent, when I was in high school, about 6 to 10 hours a day getting items and selling them at higher prices and making money in the game EverQuest. And then that money that he made in EverQuest, he'd go on to...
And sell
that money, and he ended up making, after basically working 80 hours a week doing this, making a lot of money as a high school student.
How much an hour was he making, do you know?
I'm not sure. I know at the end, senior year, he was able to purchase a car.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That is, because one of the interesting questions, of course, is my tendency when I'm doing a first approximation analysis of this is to ignore the time cost. Because after all, I'm playing it for the fun of it, so that there isn't a time cost for me. But if somebody is doing it really seriously, then, as in your case, it may actually be a productive activity for them. And then you're going to want to ask, not only can I make money, can I make enough per hour of time spent at it to make it worth doing? But the problem is, the reason this is a little surprising, it might not work, but my guess is that your friend wouldn't work now, is because we've now got Chinese gold farmers. We've now got people who are doing exactly what you're describing, but they're from societies with relatively low wages, and therefore you would expect them to be willing to do it to drive the return down to lower than probably an American high school student would be willing to do it for. But EverQuest was a long time ago, and the internet had gotten Chinatized by then, I suspect. So anyway, it's an interesting part of the world that I think is getting more and more important, not just World of Warcraft, but virtual online virtual realities of all sorts. That's what we're thinking about. All right, let me spend our last 15 minutes or so. Well, no, actually, I wanted to finish very briefly the stuff I did before, which is first, what's wrong with a monopoly? Price is greater than marginal cost for a single price monopoly, so it doesn't maximize some benefit, the rent seeking and so forth. What do you do about monopoly? One solution, one very popular solution, is regulation. So you have utilities. Electric utilities and such, which are private regulated companies, and the textbook things, you should regulate them to sell at price equal to marginal cost. You can't do that because then they lose money, and usually the regulator doesn't have a deep purse to pay them with. So you try to regulate an average cost, and that then raises the problem of how do you know what average cost is. And one form of that problem for the regulated utility is what return should they get on their capital, because they invested capital, they aren't buying it now, so how do you know? And that's why it's called rate of return regulation, because the theory is that you're giving them a price which gives them whatever that means, a fair rate of return on the capital. How do you measure the amount of capital? That's non-trivial, and as I discuss in the book, if you measure it by the stock value of the company, you've got a circular argument, because the more you let them make, the higher the stock value is going to be, so that isn't going to work. Government-run monopoly runs into many of the same sorts of problems of how do you figure out what to do, and the problem of why should the people who are regulating it care about maximizing social benefit when there are all sorts of political profits to be made by giving jobs to people who will campaign for your candidate and stuff like that. And private unregulated monopoly has the problems that we started with about charging above marginal cost and so forth. The comment that I remember my father made a long time ago was that people who are familiar with private monopoly and government monopoly are in favor of regulated monopoly. People who are in favor of regulated monopoly and private monopoly are in favor of government monopoly, and people who are in favor of the other two are all in favor. Who are familiar with the other two are in favor of the third. None of them seems to work very well, and so you always want the one you don't know. What are the problems from the cartel standpoint? Cartel problems are from two ends. One of them is you're a cartel person. What keeps you from making the money that you feel you're entitled to make? And the other side is we're victims of the cartel. How do we protect ourselves? The cartel problem, the first problem is chiseling. That since the cartel has pushed prices above costs, it's in the interest of every member of the cartel to covertly break the agreement and sell additional output at a little bit less than the cartel price, but more than its cost. So you need some way of controlling that. Second problem is that even if you have enforceable cartels, you still have the problem that as long as what's enforceable is only a contract, firms can choose not to join the cartel, and in general, a small firm is better off out than in, because if it's out, it can produce all at once, and the cartel will kindly hold prices up. And that means that if a small firm comes in, the cartel will have to offer it good terms, which means that in practice the restriction of output is going to tend to be largely by the large players, who are the ones who they don't restrict, the prices are going to go down. And I discussed briefly my analysis of what's going on with OPEC, which was that the Saudis are in favor of already low prices because they're going to have to swallow the extra output if they have high prices. What can you do about cartel? The simplest thing to do about a cartel is not to enforce cartel contracts, not to enforce so-called contracts of restraint of trade. Next step up is to make those contracts illegal as well as unenforceable, and both of those, I guess, make cartels harder. It's not clear to what extent they make them impossible, because that depends on whether people can find ways around your restrictions or not. All right, I'm going to spend a little time not as much time as I previously thought, because we found stuff to talk about, talking about some legal systems other than the ones in the book and other than the ones you're familiar with. And I want to start out with Athens, classical Athens, Periclean Athens, this famous great democracy. Do you know how officials in democratic Athens were chosen? By lot. Random selection from adult male citizens. It's sort of funny if you think about it, that in one sense, it's not clear whether things like lottery are the most fair or the least fair system. That people in one sense say, well, it's random, so that's fair. On the other hand, you could then say, well, you know, being born the son of a millionaire is random too. You don't think that's fair. And that, you know, the lottery is just as arbitrary. The explicit lottery is just as arbitrary as the lottery of fate, so to speak. But in any case, that's how they did it. So that meant it was a government of amateurs. You were selected for 1 year. And the system was one in which almost all prosecution of crimes was private. Basically, the equivalent in the Athenian system of our distinction between criminal and tort was the equivalent of tort were cases where only the victim could prosecute and would collect the damages. The cases of crime were ones where any adult male citizen could prosecute, and the punishment was normally a fine, and the prosecutor got a sizable chunk of the fine, though not all of it. That was the incentive to prosecute. And that raises an obvious problem, which is that you're going to go after deep pockets. You're going to try to find somebody rich and unpopular and use good demagogic arguments to persuade a very large jury that he's guilty of something, and then you get lots of money. And they had two ways of discouraging that. And my favorite way was they have juries of several hundred people in a jury. And if you did not get, I think it was a fifth of the jury to vote for conviction, the prosecutor was fined. Right? Obviously a bogus prosecution, which would punish him for that. And there was also a procedure at which at the end of the year you could in effect sue somebody for having done bogus prosecutions. And I don't think we know much about how that one worked. Another one of the bits of the Athenian system that I rather like as an economist, I think was elegant, is their system for producing public goods was what was called a liturgy. And what a liturgy was that if you were one of the richest Athenians, you had to produce a public good every other year. And there were magistrates, these randomly chosen magistrates, in charge of various things. So the magistrate comes up to you and he says, I don't know if you've heard, but we're sending a team to the Olympics this year. Congratulations, you're the sponsor. Or, look at that beautiful trireme down at the deck. Guess who's paying her bills this year? And there are two ways of getting out of one of these liturgies. And one of the ways is to demonstrate that you've already, this year or last year, paid for one public good. There's only one every 2 years you have to do. The other is to prove that there is another Athenian who has not done a liturgy this year, did not do one last year, and is richer than you. And so the question is, how in a VC world without accountants and banks and all the stuff we're used to, how do I prove you're richer than I am? And it's an economist's answer, not an accountant's answer. What?
Look at what they buy.
Maybe you're a miser.
Offer to switch.
That's right. I offer to trade everything I own for everything he owns, and if he turns me down, he's admitted he's richer than I am, which strikes me as a very elegant self-revealing system. How much it really happened, we aren't sure, but at least that was on paper the way the system was supposed to work. A number of other interesting things. One of my other favorite bits is if I can prove you've stolen something of mine, I not only get it back, but you owe me a fine. And one obvious way to prove you've stolen something of mine you have is to arrange to search your house and find something that I can show is mine in your house. And the obvious danger of that is that I will search your house, plant some of my property, and then claim you stole it in order to get the fine. Any guess as to how the Athenians, with their uniquely Greek approach to these matters, solve this problem? How do they make it possible for you to search for stolen stuff without making it possible for you to plant stuff? I didn't. All right, then I've told you. You can search, but you've got to be stark naked.
Yeah.
Right. I just think it's so pretty. It's sort of partly the contrast between our attitudes and theirs. I mean, nakedness was much more taken for granted in that society than it is in our society. There's a bunch of other stuff that some of the stuff that seems very weird to us, because it doesn't fit our mores, I'm not sure if you can explain it or not, but one of the rules associated with inheritance rules had to do with an heiress. And an heiress is a woman whose father dies and he has no male descendants, because normally the land and the property would go to his son or grandson. And if he dies and he has no male descendants, any male relative may marry his heiress without her permission. Even if she's already married, she's required to divorce her husband if she's already married. Of course, if she had a son, it won't happen, because then if she had a son, he would have had a male descendant. But if she has no children, has only daughters, any male relative, except those within the incest, except, you know, I think half-brothers on one side can't, on the other side can't, but I don't remember. But anyway, any male relative who isn't too close to be legal can demand that she marry him. And this is presumably a way of keeping land in the family. Yep.
Just generally curious, what if she was pregnant at the time and wasn't
dead? I don't know. If they didn't know, maybe they'd have to wait to see whether it was a boy or a girl, I suppose. Yeah.
Wait, so if she had sons, and hence
if she had sons, she's not an heiress.
She's not an heiress, so it sort of it skips a level, and she's okay.
Yeah, I don't remember what happened to her. She may have some rights, but basically, the problem really is, I think part of it is they want to have somebody who will go do the right religious rituals for the dead, and part of it maybe is keeping property in the family. But it is just sort of one of the things that sort of is weird and strikes one as weird about the system. Next one, which I don't know if I discussed here at all or not, is Imperial China. I don't remember if I discussed that. I just had some of this time before Johor, then I'm going through it. Did I talk about Cheyenne Indians? No. Cheyenne Indians are an interesting system. They, in effect, are functioning as a single nation during the summer when they come together and hunt buffalo, and as a bunch of scattered bands during the winter when they're spreading out and doing sort of hunting-gathering kind of stuff. And there is, during the summer, some sort of a formal government, although of a pretty residual sort. But there's also quite a lot of casual violence going on. And one of the interesting things to me is how you put limits on casual violence in such a society. And the way they... Yeah.
Did you say a lot of casual violence during the summer or the winter?
Both. I think both times. It's pretty clearly the kind of society where beating people up is not unusual, where fighting with people is not unusual. And fighting people is all right as long as you don't kill them. And the Cheyenne rule is that if you kill another Cheyenne, you are exiled. And excuses don't matter. Because it isn't that you're evil. It is that you smell of death. You're bad luck. You've been polluted. So it's essentially a sort of a religious or a magical sanction. And in theory, at least, there may be some exceptions, even if it was self-defense. Doesn't matter. You should have defended yourself just a little bit less effectively. And if you are found to have killed another Cheyenne and are exiled, in maybe 5 or 10 years, exile is not death, because there are other tribes that have reasonably friendly relations, and so pretty clearly a Cheyenne might go join one of the other tribes for 5 or 10 years. In 5 or 10 years, you can petition to be readmitted. And if you are clever, you will bring a horse loaded with tobacco to give to people as gifts in exchange for their voting to have you readmitted. But after you are readmitted, you still smell of death, just not as badly. And so for the rest of your life, nobody will ever share your pipe or eat from your bowl. Be bad luck for them. And that struck me as a very interesting system, because it sort of avoids all of the problems of a normal legal system of who's guilty and who isn't guilty. And it just gives people a very strong incentive to restrain themselves sort of at the extreme, to say, yes, I can beat you up, but at the last step, I don't stab you. And you get a somewhat similar pattern, oddly enough, in Norse culture. Because one of the things you have in early Norse culture is what's called holmgang, which is trial by battle. And what happens there is that you have a legal dispute, and you have a fight within a very limited space. They spread out a cloak on the ground, and then a boundary a certain distance outside the edges of the cloak, and you're supposed to be fighting within that boundary. And at least one set of rules, and I think there may have been more than one set of rules at different times, is that the fight ends when the first drop of blood hits the cloak. So it's really the first blood. And the person who bleeds loses the dispute, unless he dies, in which case he wins it. So it's giving each person an incentive to wound but not to kill. And again, it just strikes me just as an economist, sort of a clever attempt to control people's behavior by legal rules. And I can't resist describing one home gang, which I think was not being done by these rules, but it's one in Egil's saga, which is one of my favorite of the Icelandic sagas. And Egil is this, well, at one point in the saga, when somebody sees him and says something, I mean, there's a man outside, if he is a man, he looks more like a troll to me. And Egil is a very formidable character, as well as a very fine poet. And Egil is visiting the sister of his friend Arinbjorn in Norway. He's an Icelander. And the family is very upset about something, but they won't tell him what. He finally gets it out of them. And there's a berserker, a man who goes berserk in battle, who has claimed their land, on what excuse we don't know, and demanded home gang. And the only, Egil's friend, Arinbjorn, is out of town, and all that's there is his sister's 16 or 17-year-old son. And so it looks as though they're going to have to either lose the land or the son's going to have to fight and get killed. And Egil says, it's all right, I'll take care of this. And so Egil goes up against the berserker. And the trouble is that when Egil hits the berserker, the sword won't bite on him. And the implication is some sort of magic or something of that sort the berserker has. So eventually Egil gets bored with this stuff. And he throws down his sword, throws down his shield, throws down the berserker and bites his throat out. So you can see that Egil, in some sense, is the real thing that berserkers are a pale imitation of. And it's sort of a neat bit of that particular saga. Anyway, so if you want to read an Icelandic saga, let me recommend Egil's saga. It's not nearly as long as Njál's saga, and it's quite a neat story about three generations of sort of more or less human people. It's very good, thank you. Yes.
It's the worst thing to have at the end of the day is a really long class.
Oh, insurance.
What is this?
I have insurance law right now. It's like 2 hours and 10 minutes.
Starting now?
Yeah.
Are you allowed to have a bed or something and sleep in it?
Well, that would be fair. At least he doesn't care if we show up, which is nice, but